From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This hour, a look at history, or rather, a look at how history could have been different. We reached out to a variety of voices in our community who study history in various forms to help us understand how one little moment could have dramatically changed events, or sometimes a mindset, sometimes a series of events. And some of these what-if scenarios are very close to Rochester and the Finger Lakes. Some are farther flung. We'll talk about the Erie Canal, the Beatles, Watergate, our environmental history, even a look at how the world would have developed differently if the Black Death Plague in Europe had wiped out 99% of the population in the 1300s and not just a third of it. Our guests come with a wide range of expertise, so let's get started. Our next guest is going to talk to us about, well, a recent historical event. Amit Vadabial is the Arthur J. Gosnell Professor of Economics at RIT, and I always enjoy the conversation with Amit. Talking Brexit today?
That's right. What would have happened on both sides of the big ditch, so to speak, if Brexit had not occurred? And of course, one can point to a number of things, but I think three stand out. First, the extent to which the middle class on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean have basically been hurting big time would not quite have been realized by the power elites and politicians. Because when you look at globalization, and particularly economic globalization, the fact of the matter is we now have a lot of data with which to evaluate who benefits and who loses. And it's pretty clear that the big beneficiaries have been very large numbers of people in India, China, those kinds of countries. But the people who have lost out have been middle-class folks in North America, the United States primarily, and on the other side of the Atlantic in Britain. And the fact that some of these people have lost out and are hurting and have been hurting for many, many years is a phenomenon that's largely been ignored by politicians. So these people are sick and tired of being neglected and sick and tired of being promised to, and then the promise is not being delivered. So they, so to speak, vote with their feet. And here comes Brexit.
And so without Brexit, a lot of people have wondered, what if no Brexit, no Trump? What do you think?
That's a possibility, because I think the same forces that are at work in England and Western Europe more generally are also at work here. That is, a significant shrinking of the manufacturing base and large-scale unhappiness among folks who work in manufacturing and related industries because they see little growth in their wages and they're just not doing as well as they once did. So a significant part of Donald Trump's base is this disaffected group of people in, say, the Midwest, the Rust Belt, these kinds of people. So if they hadn't got the impetus that Brexit gave them, saying that, hey, look, people who are in our shoes on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean feel the same way as we do, and they are voting with their feet, and look what they just did. Hey, we can do it too. That kind of feeling might have been attenuated.
Okay. Any other what-ifs or dominoes to fall out of that?
Yeah. Two other things that come to mind are, one, I think the EU, or rather maybe I should say the gray-suited bureaucracy in Brussels, has become significantly more aware that, hey, there's something that they're not doing, in particular not communicating to the masses of people in the 28-group bloc, what exactly they stand to benefit from as a result of being part of this bloc. What folks have seen is massive disruption in, say, a country like Greece. They've seen this massive influx of refugees from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. The EU has no coherent policy about what to do. So a lot of people are asking, you know, what exactly do we benefit and how do we benefit from being a part of the European Union? And what exactly do these folks in Brussels who are paid well and seem to be, you know, having cocktails and martinis, how are they actually helping us?
So spurring maybe some action from them?
Yeah, exactly. So they're significantly more concerned and I think are trying to do what they can. But of course, their levers are limited to make sure that there is no Frexit, that is France going out, which might happen if Marine Le Pen wins next year, and trying to prevent those kinds of issues from happening across the European Union.
Okay, so that's another one.
Yep.
Anything else that stands out there?
There are a couple of others, and I think the smaller issue is a recognition now in the aftermath of Trump's win and Brexit that free trade doesn't help everybody. And this, I think, is a problem with liberal politicians, particularly in the aftermath of NAFTA, who've sold these free trade deals as win-win deals for the United States. And, you know, I teach international trade to my students, and every trade model I teach clearly says that there are winners and there are losers. There's a very nuanced sense in which economists say that free trade is beneficial in the aggregate. And what that means in simple English is that the winners win by more than the losers lose. So if we wanted to, in principle, we could compensate the losers and yet come out on top. But here's the important thing. No compensation is ever made. So free trade with China, large numbers of people in the Midwest and on the Rust Belt are decimated. Their jobs are gone. We don't do anything about them. We just sit pretty in the recognition that all consumers across the United States are standing to benefit. And as a result, even though these people are adversely affected, we win. Note, that's not a win-win case. Some people lose, and some people will always lose.
And so this is a what-if that hasn't been answered yet, but I wonder if you feel like this is a moment for the election results in our country and the Brexit results to be received by political leaders and for them not to perpetuate the status quo. In other words, especially Democrats, if they perpetuate the status quo, they will probably continue to lose.
I think that's true. But in term, as far as the Democrats are concerned, they need to understand the sense in which free trade is good for the United States and be honest about it. The fact that some people will lose, even though in the aggregate, there is a sense in which free trade benefits the United States. Now, as far as our president-elect is concerned, I fear that he may be, you know, moving too far on the other side so as to suggest that, you know, free trade is never good and that all the deals that we've negotiated as far as trade is concerned, they've all been bad for the United States. So everything needs to be just uprooted, thrown out, and we need to renegotiate everything from scratch. That doesn't make sense.
Sure. And then you've got some of these ham-fisted carrier deals that are oversold. And I mean, there's no way a president can negotiate every single company's intentions. You need macroeconomic policy. You can't be that micro and survive over 4 to 8 years.
That's right. I mean, there are some global economic forces that are at play. And President-elect Trump is just not going to be able to do things to, you know, basically turn the direction of these forces just by himself, no matter how much he tried, no matter what the bluster accompanying his campaign rhetoric. It's just not going to happen. So what you need to do is understand these forces and then craft policy. And, well, we'll see what he does.
All right. So the last what-if question that I have for you is, going forward, if a lesson is learned from Brexit, because that's where our what-if conversation began, with Brexit happening, the best-case scenario for the average worker, whether it's Europe or whether it's American workers, what's the best-case scenario that comes out of Brexit long-term?
I'll add the caveat that we don't really know how it's going to be conducted. Yeah. So there are these two scenarios that people talk about, a hard Brexit and a soft Brexit, yeah, where the basic distinction is on the following point. Are you going to have free movement of peoples across the European Union? And the people who wanted to leave the European Union don't want that. On the other hand, if you're not going to have that, then it's very, very unlikely that the powers that be in Brussels will allow England or the UK more generally to be a part of the so-called common market. So it's not clear how that particular dichotomy is going to play out, whether the Brexit will be soft or hard. And of course, that has clear implications for both the welfare of the UK and the European Union more generally. But what I think needs to be understood is that there is a clear sense in which certain segments of American society, focusing on home for a moment, are adversely affected by free trade. And we need to have explicit protections in place to help these folks who are adversely affected as a result of free trade. I mean, on the books, we have some programs called like the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program, but that's a pittance. It basically does very little. So, but we need to be cognizant of the fact that free trade is good in a particular sense and take active steps to help folks who are adversely affected by free trade.
Well, thank you very much, as always. Love learning from you and love having you. And Happy New Year, and we'll talk to you again in 2017.
All right. Thank you, Evan. Thank you for having me.
Our next guest is a professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester. And I really wondered what Adam Frank would choose when I gave him the assignment, a what if in history. And your choice is very interesting. You could have gone in a lot of different directions here, sir.
Yeah, well, I could have. When you gave me the question, I thought about all the different things in science that, you know, if somebody hadn't invented, or, you know, if a discovery hadn't been made. But actually, in thinking about this and some of the things you and I have described previously about, you know, sort of the path of history and planets, you know, overall, we've thought a lot about this. And there's this book by my favorite science fiction writer, Kim Stanley Robinson, and it's called The Years of Rice and Salt. And the question he sort of starts with is, what would have happened if the Black Plague completely wiped out Europe? You know, what we know is that about, you know, maybe 30 to 50% of the population of Europe was wiped out. But that was not so much that, you know, Europe couldn't rise again. But if you, you know, knock out enough of a population of a civilization, you know, there's just not enough people to rebuild, essentially. So if you go to 99%, clearly you're in trouble. And it's not really clear where the cutoff is, 90%. But in the book, what he imagines is that basically Europe is taken out of the picture of world history. And so then it's really about the next, you know, 600 years or 400 years or whatever it is, are really about the competition between China and the Islamic world, with India playing a sort of intermediate role. And it's just a fascinating exercise in alternative history to see how similar themes, like, you know, there's still science being played out, similar themes could have worked out, but with a very different kind of focus, with a very different kind of balance between, you know, the competing worldviews.
Now, I have not read The Years of Rice and Salt, but in preparation for this conversation, I read a lot about it, and the critics love it for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is that they feel there was a tremendous amount of thoughtful research employed here. So you have Native Americans who end up in a very prominent role here. And on the question of science, Adam, if I'm remembering correctly from what I read, there was a real concern about nuclear weaponry and kind of this pact not to use it or not to develop it among scientists. That could have happened. I mean, we probably would develop these things eventually anyway. This is a question of, does it happen sooner? Does it happen later? And what are the circumstances it happens under, right?
Right. One of the interesting things, one of the interesting conceits, so to speak, of the book is that, yes, you know, eventually North America is, you know, discovered by the, you know, by the powers on the other side of the continent. But they're discovered in such a way, actually, I think it's a Chinese character who sort of, you know, is disillusioned with China, and he kind of runs across the continent warning the Native Americans of what's coming. And in that sense, the continent is never conquered. In fact, in the end, just like what happened in our history, but in a very different way, North America becomes a dominant power at the end of the book. And it's really because, you know, and it's really interesting, this area plays a big role in it, because as the Native Americans forge themselves into a, you know, a quote-unquote modern nation, it's very much the Iroquois, the government that the Iroquois had already, that becomes sort of the basis of this trans-North American, Native American power. And there, yeah, at the end of the book, there is this debate, because, of course, the science is the science, right? I mean, whether or not it was developed in an alternative history or the history we know, there's the laws of science are the laws of science. So it is, they are still discovered in this alternative history, but they're discovered in you know, the names, the ways that they're discovered, the ways they're thought about, particularly nuclear weapons, is very different. And in that book, right, there's a real push against ever even developing any of this stuff because it's just too dangerous.
Do you find there is an intellectual benefit to having this kind of book out there, to thinking about it, or is it more just fun to think about how things play out differently, who's involved, how science unfolds maybe at a different pace? You know, is there an intellectual benefit, though, to doing this?
I think there is. I mean, you know, some people really love alternative histories, and that's not my favorite kind of science fiction, but I've read a few, and if they're done well, I think, particularly when it comes to science, asking yourselves how the science might have developed along different lines, or how there might have been different emphasis to the science. Because that's a fascinating question. Sort of, you know, what goes on inside an atom is going to be what goes on inside an atom, regardless of which way history happens. But the pace and the direction and the emphasis that different cultures or different, you know, historical strains might have placed on different discoveries, that's sort of an interesting thing to look at. I was also very interested. Another conceit of the book is that the same group of characters keep being reborn, right? So there's sort of a Buddhist theme to the story. So you keep getting the same group of characters being reborn over and over again. They die, you know, like a plague will come through and everybody's dead, and then they'll go through and wake up, for most of the book, actually, they're not waking up because they don't remember. But it's an interesting thing. At the end of the book, he has them sort of you know, awakening to the fact that they're being reborn over and over again. So that was an interesting sort of sub-theme in the book as well.
Okay, a lot of fun. The book is The Years of Rice and Salt by Kim Stanley Robinson. And last question then, because again, you chose somebody else's work here. What is one big what-if question that's at the top of your mind right now in our own science? Does it go back to climate, as we've talked a lot about? Do you have any consternation about where we are pivoting next as a society in terms of science?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I thought, the reason why when you asked me this, I thought about the years of rice and salt, because one of the things I'm doing right now is my research group, a collaborator and I, as we talked about on the show earlier, we've finally done the mathematical models of, you know, an exo-civilization, a civilization on a generic planet, interacting with its planet and the different trajectories that you can get to. And one of the things we've seen in our solutions is you can get die-offs, right? It's a very common thing when you've got a you know, large-scale civilization using a lot of energy on its planet, feeding back on its planet, that, you know, you might be able to come to a sustainable, you know, a long-term level of population, but often you go through an overshoot. And so, you know, how dangerous are overshoots, right? If you lose 50% of your population in an overshoot very rapidly, you know, are you going to be able to recover from that? If you lose 90% of your population, are you going to be able to recover that? So this question of, you know, if you can even get to sustainability, what if getting there requires, you know, a pretty substantial loss of your population? Does that really mean that, you know, you can't get there? So that's kind of where that question came from for me.
You know, the rudest thing about science is there's a lot of what ifs, and there will be answers. We just don't get to see most of them.
Yes,
you and me specifically, but future generations, they'll have plenty of answers on this.
Yeah, they'll have plenty of answers. Yeah, for good or ill, they'll see how it works out.
I always enjoy it, my friend. Thank you. Happy New Year. Talk to you in 2017.
As well to you. Take care.
Our next guest is Michael Galvin, a curator and historian at the Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganondagan. It's always nice to have a conversation with Michael. Thanks for coming back in here.
Thank you, Evan. It's
a
pleasure.
Well, so Michael made a little confession to me, and I think it's important to say this. Some people love sort of alternative histories, and some people think, it's kind of a waste of time. History is history. You're not a huge fan of the what-if genre, but I think you've got an interesting exercise, it sounds like, today.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I don't talk normally about what-if history.
But I twisted your arm enough.
This will work, though.
Okay. Well, so what do you want us to think about then today with this?
Well, my story is in two parts. And the first part was, it really comes from a story that was recorded in the late 1800s about a specific location in western New York and a Seneca town. And the story involves Seneca ideology, worldview, and perceptions of the natural forces of the world. It's a... The story focuses on a place known as Cayuga Creek, which is one of the inlets to the Niagara River. And as the story goes, there was a community there of Seneca people, and they were suffering from an illness, which was unknown. People were wasting away, and they were dying. And turns out that a young girl who was very scared for her community was made an appeal out into the universe and was asking for help. And one day she went down to the outlet where the river flows into the Niagara River, and there she was going to take and bathe. Well, these rattlesnakes came out of the rocks and pushed her, scared her into the river, and she was swept down the river over the falls. To her unexpected delight, she did not die over the falls, and in fact woke up in a cave. And there she met this entity, which Seneca people will call Hietno, or the thunder beings who live in the Niagara Falls. And there he explained to her what was going on in her community. He explained that there was a giant serpent, and this underworld being lived near her town, and it would take and use that outlet, use the bay of Cayuga Creek, and roll in the bay with the stones of the bay, removing this filth and toxins that would build on its skin. And that, in fact, was what was poisoning her people. And the serpent did this because it relied on the dead remains of the villagers, and that's how it lived. So it was predating on them. But he had a plan. And so he sent her back with this plan, which she presented to her people. the people were asked to remove. They were asked to bring their belongings, load them into a canoe, into canoes, and paddle upstream away from their town. They were going to abandon their town. And as the thunder being Hitno described, when the snake, when the serpent, who they call Osaisdowane, the giant serpent, when he realizes that his prey is leaving, he's going to emerge and follow them. And at that point, the thunder beings can then strike them down with their lightning. And in fact, this did happen. The people removed in their canoes, and indeed the black horned giant serpent being emerged, and Hitno caused rain and mist to emerge from the falls, which he rode into the sky and struck down with his lightning arrows onto the giant serpent, and it withered and writhed and perished and was pushed all the way down to the falls, where it lodged on the banks and created what we call Horseshoe Falls. The people were saved. They relocated to a new community, which people will call now Buffalo Creek. And as a sign of his pact and promise to the people, they sent men back to their old village to witness a giant pole that had been erected in their old town with the desiccated remains of a portion of its body hanging from 70 feet up to the ground, a giant appendage, and the people were saved. And that's the first part of the story. It's a story that people have told in different variations. The version that I tell was collected in the 1890s, and then I have to bring the story out into a different context.
Okay.
So, as we know, Western New York was largely populated, you know, after the Erie Canal was formed and settlement happened. And in the end of the 1800s, we were entering the age of electrification. And there was a person who had this idea that he could create a sluiceway between bodies of water. And this sluiceway, this canal or aqueduct, could be used to generate electricity with like turbines. And this was a great plan, but during the construction phase, there was a financial collapse, and the funding dried up, so to speak, and he had to abandon his plan. But this ditch, which he had created, was actually quite big and was just left. It filled in with water, and people really didn't know what to do with it. So as Buffalo began to grow up and companies began to move in towards this really tight funnel between Canada and the U.S., they began to create factories and you know, business and industry was booming. And then we start to face troubles in the globe and World War. We had just left World War I, and World War II was really a reality, and the U.S. and the Army began to set about preparing for this war, and very big companies started to emerge in this area, and they produced chemicals, and they needed a place to put the remnants, the byproducts of this chemical process somewhere. The waste. And so they thought, well, we have this unfinished ditch, let's throw it in there, which they did. They put it in barrels, and probably during from about the 1940s until the mid-1950s, it was used as a dump by the city of Buffalo, by large chemical companies like DuPont, Hooker, Union Carbide, and they filled it over. They covered it all up, put clay on top, and left it. Well, the city of Buffalo decided that they would start to develop the area, and having really forgotten the history of that area, began to build homes and communities and schools and things on this property. And a couple of times in the 1950s, actually, during the boom after World War II, as these communities were emerging, there was periods of tremendous rain and heavy snowfall, which caused actually some of that old material to emerge. And sometimes they would, areas where these containers were stored would collapse, but then they would fill in with water and kids would play on them and skate on them in the winter and people forgot really what was going on until the 1970s. And in the 1970s, late 1970s, the community that lived in the area started to notice that they were becoming sick and ill. They didn't have a reason. They didn't know why. Children were coming home from school with burns from playing in the playgrounds. Children were coming home very ill. Their tests really were not confirming any one source of the problem. But about 1976 and 1977, the rains came, and they brought with them tremendous water, and it saturated the grounds around this area. And in people's backyards, barrels of toxic waste and chemicals emerged. And the people began to be concerned, and attention was drawn to the location. And over a period of few years, till the early 1980s, about 1,000 families had to be relocated. And they were relocated. The area was shut down because it was too toxic for humans to live. And so that is the story that I wanted to tell you. And the location is Cayuga Creek. And the location today, people call it Love Canal. So my story really is, in so much as it's a what if, I think that had people really understood, all along that story, there were mistakes made. And from a perspective, a native perspective, we would call that serpent greed. We would call it greed. And we would call the rains that came was the thunder beings trying to warn the people. They did it a couple times until finally people did pay attention. So my what if is, actually, what if when America was being created, when the settlement period was over, what if people really were paying more attention to the environment? What if they had concern for the future generations? What if they really set aside their economic goals and their desire to make more and more profit and really were concerned about their children as Seneca people do, as Haudenosaunee people do, and as all of our stories talk about? What if those things really would have taken precedent? And what if all those people didn't become sick? What if we cared for the earth the way that we've been saying all along?
We wouldn't have had barrels buried in backyards, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah.
Thanks for giving us something to think about, by the way.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Michael Galban is a curator and historian at the Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganondagan. It's a great place to learn a lot more about our history, our American history, our Native American history, and how it all weaves together. And I'm glad Michael joined us today, and we'll talk to you again in 2017.
Thanks, Evan.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour and come back with more What If History on Connections.
This is your next president, Donald J. Trump. And if you like things that are the best, fantastic, and really terrific, then listen to the Capitol Steps New Year's radio special right here on this public radio station.
This afternoon at 1 on WXXI.
I'm Evan Dawson. On Monday, no Connections. We've got special national programming. We're celebrating the new year, and all of us at Connections wish you a happy new year and a wonderful 2017. We hope you've enjoyed Connections in 2016, and we hope you continue to join the program in various ways throughout the next year as we seek to bring all voices in our community together for conversations that matter to Western New York. We're talking history, and we're sort of talking what if history. What if something that did happen didn't, or something that almost happened did? What are those little moments that changed everything? And our next guest is someone who, he knows more about the history of popular music than anybody I've ever met. He's the director of the Institute for Popular Music at the University of Rochester, John Kovach. Nice to see you. Was this a fun assignment that I gave you?
It was, but I didn't have to think about it for too long because okay. I think I came up with the event that, well, there probably are a couple of events that I could talk about, but this one I think is...
All right. What's the band in question?
It's the Beatles.
Okay, what happened or didn't?
Well, we all know the story about the Beatles and Ed Sullivan and I Want to Hold Your Hand and what a major change that affected in the music business and all of that. And the temptation is to say, what would have happened if the Beatles had never played on Ed Sullivan? But in fact, when they were on Ed Sullivan, one of the things that made that so important is that they already had a number one single. So if they had not played Ed Sullivan, at that point they already had a number one single, and people knew about them because they greeted them at the plane before they were even on the show. The real event I think that makes for interesting thinking has to do with Washington, D.C., and reportedly a 14-year-old girl by the name of Marsha Alberts, who was listening to a local radio station, WWDC, and there was a disc jockey on there by the name of Carol James, who's, like a lot of AM disc jockeys, had a kind of a way of doing his show. And part of it was, you know, send in your requests, we can honor any request, this kind of thing. Well, this girl had seen a small news item on American television, one of these news items they put on 5 minutes before the hour, kind of a fluff piece about culture. And it was their roving reporter in England, in London, talking about this kooky group called the Beatles that were having so much success in England. And she saw that, and I think they were singing She Loves You on that particular clip, and she thought they were fantastic. So she asked this DJ, you know, could you play some music by the Beatles? Well, this guy looked and looked, and he couldn't find, you know, much in terms of Beatles. It turned out that he found out, a big thing in England. And so he knew somebody, or somehow was able to get a hold of somebody at BOAC, the British Airway, to bring back a Beatles record so he could play it. What a great thing for a DJ to say, we can honor any request, even from those that come from around the world, right? So they bring the record back. It was I Want to Hold Your Hand, which had just been released at the end of November. They bring it back, and they ask this young girl to come into the studio. If you watch the new Ron Howard film, there's actually a clip where you can hear her introducing it for the first time in the United States, the Beatles singing I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Wow.
Well, like would happen in any kind of a Hollywood movie, all of a sudden the switchboards light up. Everybody loves this song. This guy, Carol James, again, an AM DJ, sees a real opportunity here. He doesn't share it with any of his other DJ friends in the DC area. It's exclusive for him. He plays the record over and over and over again. He's got buddies, one in Chicago, one in St. Louis, both who've got radio shows. He makes reel-to-reel tape copies of I Want to Hold Your Hand. They play it. Same reaction there. In fact, it seemed to be breaking out in these major markets without an American release. Capitol, what the record company that the Beatles were eventually signed to, actually tried to take out a lawsuit against these DJs for playing their music on the radio, until somebody finally said, hey, these people aren't, this, we're not supposed to sue them for playing our music, we're supposed to pay them for playing our music.
And it all goes back to this girl?
Yeah, because what happened is the Beatles had already been booked to play the Ed Sullivan Show, unrelated to any of this, but they had never had any kind of a hit in this country. So what that might have looked like if they did not have a hit record at the time might have been very different. It might have gone the way of somebody like Cliff Richards, who had tons and tons of hit records. Cliff Richards, again, who, right?
Exactly.
Who had a whole series of hits in the late 50s and the early 60s, was as big as Elvis in the UK, but couldn't get a record really on the charts here. So had it not been for Marsha Alberts, and it ended up forcing Capitol to release the record as soon as they could, they finally got wise and thought, we're going to take advantage of this. They released the record as fast as they could. It ended up being released on the 26th of December, 1963. Who releases a record on the day after Christmas? But that was the soonest they could get the vinyl pressed and the labels printed and get them into shops so they could take advantage of what they thought was this flavor of the week kind of fervor for the Beatles. It went up the charts. By the end of January, it was number one on Cashbox. By the beginning of February, it was number one on Billboard. And on February 9th, the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. Were it not for Marsha Alberts and her request, it might not have worked out that way at all, and popular music might look an awful lot different.
And it's actually possible that they would have been mildly successful for a short run, but never the megastars. And we might not even really know their names today.
And it might have been that the Beatles would have continued to have some success in this country. It's just that the sort of perfect storm of all those events coming together not only created a craze for the Beatles, but it opened the door for so many other British groups that people thought were sort of sound alike and look alike, like the Animals, like the Dave Clark Five, eventually Jerry and the Pacemakers, and of course the Rolling Stones. I would say that the Rolling Stones would have had a much tougher time having any success in this country had it not been for the Beatles breaking the door open. And part of them breaking the door open was breaking it open so big because of the coming together of the hit record, the Ed Sullivan Show, all those things.
If you remember, John was on this program in 2014 because you were teaching a class 50 years since the Ed Sullivan Show.
Right.
And teaching a class on the Beatles and marking that occasion. And you go back and you look at the old tape of the Ed Sullivan Show, and people are going crazy mm-hmm. when the Beatles show up. Just like you said, they came in and their people were waiting for the plane, right?
Right.
So even though they would have been on the show,
yes,
just the energy about it would have been very different, right?
Yeah, and Capitol had planned to release the single, as I understand it, but they were planning on releasing it in mid-January in advance of their appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. But, you know, I mean, it became a hit in spite of Capitol's initial efforts, you know? And then they put, you know, Brian Epstein asked for, I think it was $40,000 for promotion for The Beatles Are Coming. But no American group had ever broken through the way the Beatles, I mean, no British group had ever broken through in America the way the Beatles did. And I'm not sure it would have ever happened just that way had it not been for this accident of coincidence of things coming together and a young girl who saw something on TV. You know, the interesting thing about that little clip on television is it was aired just before President Kennedy was assassinated. And mm-hmm. so then it wasn't aired again for a long time because the news was taken up with yeah. Kennedy, the assassination, the funeral, and all that went with it. It was, you know, it was a big news taking up everybody's attention. And so it was a blip. They were on the TV for just a minute, and this girl happened to see it. She made the request, and all of a sudden, the record took off.
Well, now you know. John Kovach, director of the Institute for Popular Music at the University of Rochester. What's her name again, by the way?
Marcia Alberts.
Marcia Alberts and the history of the Beatles. Thanks for coming in. Happy New Year, and we'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure.
Our next guest is here. We're talking to Christine Radarsky, the Rochester City historian, in our continuing conversations in which we ask people in our community of various expertise to tell us how history could have been different if one little, sometimes big, or one decision was different. So Christine had, a lot of possibilities as you look at this. Was this a fun assignment? I hope. I've been asking everyone, did you enjoy this assignment?
It's a little fun. Yeah, it's interesting to consider the possibilities.
Okay, and you chose something related to the Erie Canal?
Yes.
What's the story?
Well, the Erie Canal did not have to go through Rochester. There were several other routes that had been considered. So what would Rochester have been like if the canal hadn't passed through it?
Taking us back to when? When was this happening?
So the Erie Canal was first approved in 1817. And at that time, there had been several proposals. They had actually been talking about a canal as early as the 18th century, but it wasn't until 1817 that the legislature decided to move forward with this plan. But one of the things that some people thought might be a better way to go about it would be to go up the Mohawk Valley and up through the Oswego River and out onto Lake Ontario. Fortunately for Rochester, the War of 1812 sort of put a damper on that plan as people became more afraid of sailing on Lake Ontario.
Oh, interesting. So the War of 1812 helped cement Rochester's route on the Erie Canal.
That was one reason, yes.
Okay. All right.
There were also several other larger communities that were developing to our south along a more southern route at that point in time. Auburn, Canandaigua, Batavia were all growing at that point in time. So there was a proposal to take a more southern route for the canal as well. What happened there, though, was unfortunately once they started to study that route, they realized that filling the canal would have taken water away from those communities' milling operations. So communities that had once been advocating to have the canal through their community now realized that that would have a detrimental effect in some ways. So the idea was that they would come through what's now Rochester. There were several proposals. Do you build a dam? Do you build an aqueduct? How do you get across the Genesee River? And they decided that the aqueduct would be the best way. So now we have a beautiful aqueduct in downtown Rochester that is a feature for our community.
Okay. And what would have been different in terms of the growth of Rochester? I guess, or even more broadly speaking, how do you see Rochester evolving differently without the canal?
Well, you know, the canal really spurred the growth of Rochester. As soon as it was announced that the canal was being built and that the path would be coming through Rochester, the community just started to boom. The canal is what really made Rochester America's first boom town. You had a population of about 1,500 people living in Rochester in 1820. By within 10 years, that had grown by sixfold to over 9,000 people, and the growth would continue on for the next 20 or 30 years. So you see Rochester becoming what was known as the Young Lion of the West. People were drawn to this area because they knew that between the water power of the Genesee River and the transportation opportunities of the Erie Canal, they would be able to get their raw materials into the city of Rochester. They would be able to then export the products produced here, and they would be able to use the water power to do the flour milling and all of the types of work that would grow up in Rochester. So you had a robust canal boat business, building business here in Rochester. You had lumber coming in and out. The lumber, ease of ability to transport the lumber led to a robust furniture business here in Rochester. And most of these things never would have happened without the Erie Canal. Instead, if they had taken the Oswego route, you might have seen what's now the neighborhood of Charlotte develop, because it would have been at the head of the transportation port.
Okay, so this city, though, could have been still pretty sleepy for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
When the canal was announced, Rochester was still sort of a sleepy backwoods community. And it was really the canal that drove people into Rochester.
And how long would that have been the case? What do you think today Rochester would look like had that not happened?
Well, that is a very difficult question to ask.
Well, that's the part of the fun here.
Yes, of course. Well, you know, I don't think Rochester ever would have developed into the industrial powerhouse that it did become, because you would have had other communities developing, and that is where those business leaders would have gone. They would have gone to Oswego, or they would have gone to Canandaigua or Batavia. So you could have seen Rochester becoming remaining a sleepy village.
And certainly no Kodak here, no B&L, no Xerox, likely the big three.
Exactly. And, you know, many of those industries were founded by immigrants who came to Rochester via the canal. You know, we had our Irish immigrants coming to help build the canal. Once the canal was built, it brought in German and British immigrants, and, you know, on and on and on. So all of those people would have likely ended up elsewhere without the canal coming through here.
Thanks for coming in and sharing with us here. What do you think the future of the canal should be? You know, your job as a historian is to look back.
That's a great idea. Actually, we're pondering the future of the aqueduct right now. Yeah. We know that our community has been looking at some proposals that could affect that. So I've been giving a lot of thought to this lately. And I do think that aqueduct is a gem in our community. And I hope that we'll find a way to be able to preserve it and to continue to allow access to it so that its history can continue to be appreciated. And, you know, one of the things about the Erie Canal is, of course, we know that since the canal was abandoned, it's been put to so many other uses, between the subway and now the graffiti art that's in the aqueduct. So the history of the Erie Canal continued in many different ways, even after it passed out of use as a waterway.
Thanks for giving us some interesting things to think about in our What If Hour. Christine Radarsky is the city historian for the city of Rochester. Happy New Year. Talk to you in 2017.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you.
Our next guest, as we discuss these hinge points in history, the what ifs, the what if something did or did not happen, how something would be different. My next guest is Tim Nealon, who is the chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. And I gave him a big open-ended assignment. You could have gone to any decade in American history you chose. You chose the 1970s.
I chose the 1970s because I think it has had one of the greatest impacts upon the life we lead right now. And it is 1972. It's June 17th, and there's a man named Frank Wills, who's the security guard at the Watergate apartment and office complex.
Young guy?
Young guy. He's 24 years old. He's new to D.C. He's only been there a couple of years. He moved up from Georgia and fell in love with the place. And he's making his rounds, and he notices the basement door has been taped so it will not lock. Huh, he says to himself. That happens a lot. Maintenance people do this. He goes on break. But something tells him to go back and look at that again, and it's been taped open again. And that's when he notifies his boss, and then he calls the District of Columbia police, and they catch five burglars in the offices of the Democratic National Committee, and Watergate, as we know it, happens.
Now, what I think is really interesting about this what if is that, as you say, Tim, the first time noticing the tape on the door, he could very well logically have said, oh, that's somebody who needed to keep that door open because they're hauling stuff in or whatever, which happens
exactly.
All the time. So had he not had said, I'm just going to go back one more time, because that's a coin flip. He doesn't have to do that, right?
No, absolutely. And if it hadn't somehow triggered something in his head and nagged at him to look again, which again, is he noticed those kind of things a lot in the past, and yet he went back and he calls the police, and if they had not caught those burglars, then there's no criminal investigation, there's no FBI investigation, there's no obstruction of justice, therefore, by the President of the United States, and Watergate, as we know it, does not happen. And Richard Nixon does not resign from office, and he finishes his 4 years in office, and who knows who the next president is. It's probably not going to be Jimmy Carter, and Ronald Reagan may never have been president if Richard Nixon had not had to resign.
Okay, so before I get to those dominoes, because I'm fascinated about how the next several decades played out there, some people say, well, couldn't there have been a congressional investigation? Couldn't they have figured out that there were some shenanigans happening? Or, you know, couldn't there have been some other way to uncover what was going on?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, shenanigans from elections were investigated all the time and usually led to legislation like the creation of the Federal Elections Commission. And these kind of investigations do happen. But without a criminal complaint, it's very likely that no one would have thought that there was a cancer on the presidency. Certainly the Republicans in Congress would have had a strong hand to quash any Democratic investigation trying to ferret out the bad behavior of the President of the United States. He would have probably been very insulated. Remember, he just won the 1972 election with 60% of the popular vote, and he won every state except the District of Columbia and Massachusetts, so that he was sitting as a very popular president, and the Republicans would have done everything to protect him.
By the way, doesn't it seem like a totally different millennia thinking of a country in which any political candidate could win that many states? That's really amazing.
Yeah. In a 50-50 nation, that just doesn't happen anymore, right? Yeah, you're right. And some of that is probably an outgrowth of the rise of the conservatives in the Republican Party, which came to power in part because somewhat moderates like Richard Nixon bailed out. And then there was that Watergate, if you will, the Watergate babies, the congressional elections of 74 and 76 that put so many new Democrats in. And the reaction to that, of course, led to the rise of Ronald Reagan, as did the presidency of Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter's an outsider. It's very unlikely he would have been president in 76. Maybe instead it's Ted Kennedy, who was the liberal standard bearer for the Democratic Party. Or if they were going moderate, maybe someone like Henry Scoop Jackson, right, who was kind of tough on defense, but moderate when it came to social policies.
And if not a Ronald Reagan, who?
I think maybe Nelson Rockefeller gets his chance. He was certainly, it's very likely that Rockefeller was going to run in 76. Maybe he runs, maybe gets the nomination, maybe he loses, but maybe he comes back in 1980 and wins the election.
Now, you know, Reaganites are real believers, and I understand why, that this was a man with tremendous political talent. This was a man who helped lead a movement, and that his time was coming no matter what happened with Watergate or not. No?
No. Well, I think you have to understand every election is in the context of that election, and the events that surround that propel certain people to power. The election, for example, of President-elect Donald Trump might not have happened had there not been a President Barack Obama. Some historians and political scientists elect the person that's completely opposite from the person that's been in office. And we don't generally go to political outsiders unless there's some sort of scandal or some sort of stress and concern. And I think, you know, as we looked at some of the events of the past 18 months, they may have helped propel Donald Trump to power.
Some who are students of history, and more so than me in this case, so let me ask a question based on largely on ignorance. Could Ted Kennedy have won given the name Mary Jo Kopechne?
You know, that haunted him in the early 1970s. But remember, in 1980, he came back and he came within, you know, a hair's breadth of getting the nomination from sitting incumbent president
Jimmy Carter. That's incredible.
Yeah, when you think about that, I really do think that, again, if you had a, I think if Richard Nixon's second term, he would have stripped back some of the social policies like the EPA, maybe some of the other liberal policies that he'd allowed to proliferate in his first term in office, in part to appease Democrats in Congress. That would have made a need maybe for someone like a Ted Kennedy to stand up to a more conservative, certainly moderately conservative, Republican Party. And that might have made him a better fit in 1976 if we're moving away from Richard Nixon, not Gerald Ford, and the 2 years of economic chaos and the pardon that made Ford seem like a sketchy character. Some people thought it was a corrupt bargain that he made to become president. And so all of these things don't happen. And so the future is very different.
All right. Last question then. Frank Wills himself sadly did not have all that happy a life, did he?
No. In fact, all the attention he received from the Watergate investigation, the reporters, and some he got some pushback from some of his colleagues on the job, it haunted him. He wasn't ready for that kind of pressure. He ends up losing his job. He ends up moving back to Georgia, and he died in 2000. So he didn't even live much longer. He was a fairly young man when he passed.
Yeah, dying pretty young. Yeah, that's too bad. Well, Tim Mielen, helping us think about the world and how different things would be if just that tape on the door and a 24-year-old security guard didn't think, I'm going to go back one more time. Amazing. Amazing how things go one way or the other. Huh?
History is contingent.
Tim Mielen is the chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. Happy New Year. See you in 2017. That's our show today. Thanks for listening. We've had a wonderful year on Connections. Producer Megan Mack and I want to thank you for joining us each weekday afternoon and for the many contributions you have made to the program throughout this year. This is our community's show. It's not my show. It's not our show. It's our community's show. And we hope to build on that in 2017. I'm Evan Dawson. From all of us here at Connections, Happy New Year.